The Heaven Field, a novel by I.G. Hume, read by the author. Episode 3, Shipwrecked.
What the bloody hell was that?
Breathed Grace quietly. The ground shook slightly, and her coffee cup fell off the edge of the desk, spilling onto the floor. The lights dimmed, went off and came back on again. The fire alarm started. "What's happening?" she called above the shrill bells and sirens. Everybody in the room looked around, not knowing whether to continue work or start the evacuation. "Will somebody tell me what's going on?" she yelled. "All my displays have gone off," shouted Morgan, a senior technician from across the room. "I think we should evacuate," yelled Jane. Grace looked at her without hope. "But we've got to get the array powered up again. We need to send the beacon."
The lights flickered again, and more systems went black.
"I'm not getting any response from B subsystems," called Morgan, now standing at another desk. "Emergency shutdown procedures have commenced."
"What the hell's happening? Morgan, get B subsystems on the phone. Find out what's happening."
Grace held her head in her hands, muttering to herself in the chaos.
"All the lines are dead," yelled Morgan, anxiously over the din.
"Look, Grace," said Jane as calmly as she could over the alarms. "We don't mind staying here to try and help get them out, but it's useless. The array's gone into shutdown. You know we can't do anything more. Besides, we may be putting everyone here in danger. We need to evacuate, then find out what's going on. That's the best we can do for the team now. Come on."
She led Grace to the door and nodded to the others. They grabbed their things and hurried towards the fire exits.
"Will they bring Patty out with them?" murmured Grace in a state of shock, as Jane led her up the endless flights of stairs.
"I'm sure they will," comforted Jane. "I'm sure they will."
Alex watched absent-mindedly as the taxi drove off through the gates, leaving him alone outside the airport. He still hadn't shaken off his earlier, gloomy mood, and he stood gazing at the bustle of people entering and leaving the building. After a short while, he walked in through the automatic doors, rummaging for his tickets as he went. The concourse was small and sparsely populated. Alex always disliked provincial airports, preferring the anonymity of larger terminals. He looked at his ticket again. It read Stansted as the destination. He'd been trying to work it out during the taxi ride. He had assumed he'd be going straight back to the safe house in Prague. He was only a couple of 100 miles away from London. He could probably drive it in the same time as fly. Still, it wasn't that peculiar that they kept him in the dark. Just strange that Dragor hadn't mentioned anything. He had a couple of hours before the flight, so he toured the newsagent and bought himself a newspaper. He sat in the coffee bar for the rest of the time, drinking weak, tepid coffee. "Mr. Green," came a voice from behind him, and he snapped out of his reverie. Green was his cover name. He looked around to see a short, powerful-looking man, wearing a dark, ill-fitting suit that pulled at his broad shoulders. The man approached his table and sat down in the chair opposite. Alex nodded a welcome, while surreptitiously easing his chair away from the table.
"There's been a change of plan," grunted the man.
He was balding, in his mid-40s, thick-set and muscular. Yet his movements were quick and elegant. He carried himself like a boxer, thought Alex.
"Your fee is here, not at your destination. Someone will give it to you later, before you board your plane."
"Isn't that a little risky?"
said Alex slowly, looking up from the newspaper. The big man shrugged as if he couldn't care less, then stood up and left without looking back. Alex carried on reading his newspaper, and took a sip of coffee, seemingly unaffected by the encounter. He didn't look up. He knew he'd never spot any surveillance, whether they were there or not, and he was sure they were. Outwardly, he looked like any calm traveller relaxing in a cafe, but inside his mind was racing. What the hell was going on? He always picked up his fee from a locker at the destination airport. He'd never met the thick-set man before, so what had gone wrong? Or was he being set up? It made no sense. They knew he was bound to worry if they dropped something like this on him, so why didn't he get an explanation?
The call for his flight came over the tannoy, and he nonchalantly stood and made his way up the escalator. He walked slowly, warily glancing at the other travellers, trying to spot anything out of the ordinary. He handed his ticket to a weary-looking stewardess and walked out onto the tarmac where his plane waited. The man said they'd give him his fee before he boarded the plane, thought Alex. Yet he was almost at the steps now. Had they messed up? He put his foot on the first step.
Sir! Your case, sir!
A stewardess dashed breathlessly up towards him.
That gentleman,
she gestured behind her.
Oh, he's gone. Anyway, he said you'd left your case in the cafe.
Oh, dear me! Heavens, how stupid of me! Exclaimed Alex. Oh, thank you, thank you, he said.
He looked hard into her face for any sign of recognition, but there was none.
You really should be more careful, sir, she chastised. You should never leave your belongings unattended. Would you like to check that everything's still there?
No, I'm sure it's all right. There's nothing really of value in it anyway, just a few odds and ends.
He flashed her an apologetic smile.
But thank you. You really are most kind and considerate. An angel.
She smiled in embarrassment and wished him a pleasant flight, then walked back into the airport. Alex's heart raced, but he climbed the steps without hesitating and looked for a seat. He chose one next to a nervous-looking businessman who pretended to be engrossed in a newspaper. The man was about 50 years old, chubby with a short, neat beard. He looked up for a second as Alex sat down, then quickly turned back to his paper, eager to avoid eye contact. Alex sat staring at the case on his knees. It was a normal-looking, slightly battered laptop case. He drummed his fingers on the lid, deep in thought. 5 minutes passed. He came to a decision. He took a deep breath and turned with a beaming smile on his face to the large man in the window seat next to him.
"Well, my friend," he exploded in a hugely exaggerated accent. "Such a fine day to be travelling, yes? Around this beautiful country, all these beautiful people."
The businessman stared at him in horror, turning visibly pale.
"This is your country, no? England, beautiful England, yes?"
He beamed a ridiculous grin at the man, who shrank further into his seat.
I'm sorry, stuttered the panicking man. Yes, I am English, he muttered, trying to turn back to his paper.
I love England! I love English! You're also very friendly.
Alex carried on in his ridiculous tone. He was leaning up close to the man, leering gaily at him.
I come from Poland, and have been 3 times in England now. You're also very friendly.
Thank you,
whimpered the man, trying to bury his face further into the newspaper. Alex, still beaming, placed a warm, friendly hand on the man's arm, pushing the paper down a little.
I'm in shoes,
he exclaimed to the horrified man, who had now fully realised that he sat next to the passenger from hell.
What?
He blurted out, eyes wide with panic.
Shoes! I sell shoes! All around Poland! Everybody wears my shoes! Józef Płaclaw!
He yelled, offering his outstretched hand to the stricken man.
Benning, George Benning,
blurted out the man before he could stop himself, feebly shaking Alex's hand. Alex found it hard not to laugh. The English was so easy, he thought, so polite. He released Benning's hand, and with his other, Alex surreptitiously placed the man's stolen wallet into his pocket.
We fly soon, George?
He asked, leaning a little closer.
A couple of minutes,
replied George, looking green.
Good! You know, I think I take a piss first.
He laughed heartily, squeezing Benning's arm.
Yes, down the aisle,
gasped George, in relief at getting rid of the madman, even for a few seconds, then quickly turned to the window, scrutinising his paper. Alex stood up, still grinning stupidly, and opened the overhead locker, placing the laptop case inside. He shot a glance at Benning, who was still studying his paper, desperately ignoring him. Alex calmly took out Benning's trench coat and hat from the locker, closed the door and walked down the aisle whistling. He walked through the dividing doorway, past the toilets and into the next aisle. He had pulled on the stolen coat by now and flipped up the collar. It was enormous on him, but it would have to do. Everybody was seated, awaiting takeoff. A stewardess noticed him and walked down the aisle to where he stood looking nervous.
Sir, you'll have to return to your seat now. The plane is about to... Oh, God!
Alex had doubled over in agony, and then slumped to the floor, clutching his chest.
Sir, are you all right? Can you hear me?
The frantic stewardess knelt beside him, trying to loosen his tie. Alex coughed and sobbed, thrashing around as if having a fit.
"I can't do it! I can't! Please!"
he moaned through clenched teeth. "Sir, you'll be all right. I'll get some help. Just a moment."
"It's my pills!" he said between gasps. "I've lost my pills. I'm terrified. I can't fly without them!"
he sobbed again, still clutching his chest. Passengers looked on concernedly, and several more stewards had gathered around.
"I must get off! I must get off!"
he coughed hysterically.
"I'm sorry. I'm so sorry."
"Don't worry. You'll be all right," she said, a little calmer. She sighed and, turning to one of the stewards, said quietly, "Steve, inform the captain that we need to remove one of the passengers, and that we'll need a paramedic." She turned to where Alex lay sweating and wild-eyed. "Do you think you can walk?" she said. "You do realize that you'll miss this flight if you get off now."
"Please, just let me out. I haven't got my pills. I need my pills,"
he sobbed in another attack of mania. Two stewards helped him out of the plane and across the windswept tarmac. Alex stooped over with Benning's hat and coat hiding his features. 10 minutes later he was sitting in an office with a blanket around him, sipping hot chocolate.
"I'm so sorry to have been such a nuisance," he said in his very best British accent. I normally have these pills, you see. Absolutely terrified of flying, of dying in a crash. Always have been, but I forgot them, the pills."
The kind-hearted travel operator nodded sympathetically, interspersing Alex's apologies with warm words of understanding. Eventually, after a long pause, she said,
"Well, if you're sure you're up to it, your flight will be the 8:03, which I'm afraid gives you just under 4 hours to kill."
She winced at her choice of words. Alex stood up and thanked her for her help as they walked out of the office together.
"Oh, there's Tracy," she exclaimed. "She'll be on the next flight. She'll look after you. Tracy, hi, this is a Mr. Benning. He had a bit of trouble on the 4:20. He's a little nervous of flying. Could you be a dear and look after him on the 8:03?
Tracy, a short, cheerful girl, gave Alex a warm smile.
"Of course," she beamed. "I'll meet you at the gate before you go on, and we can board together."
"Thank you," said Alex gratefully.
"You've all been so kind to me. I don't know how I can thank you enough."
"It's all part of the job, Mr. Benning," laughed Tracy. "Please, call me George," he smiled.
Alex walked quickly out of the concourse, his oversized Mac pulled tightly around him, the stolen hat down low. He hailed a taxi and sat himself in the back seat.
"Where to?" grunted the driver.
"The coach station, please," he replied. He sat back as the taxi pulled away and watched the planes as they took off and landed. He could always try and pick up the case when he got to London, he thought, although something told him it might be wiser just to forget all about it.
"I trust he got on board safely?" asked the man, as the car slowed to a halt in the dark alley, the roar of an aircraft screaming overhead. The thick-set man who had approached Alex in the coffee bar looked up from his thoughts.
"I watched him get on the plane myself, Mr. Spears," he muttered.
"And did he protest at all?" inquired Spears, straightening his tie with a languid smile on his face.
"He didn't have much of a choice, did he?" drawled the squat figure, scratching his bald head.
He shuffled uncomfortably in the back seat.
"I can't get used to these damn British toy cars," he grunted, avoiding the other man's eye. "Well, once we have that office clerk, Drago Milovich, there'll be no reason for you to remain here, will there?"
Spears lit a cigar. The glow of the flame revealed a gaunt face in its mid-60s. The bald man swallowed nervously.
"He won't be a problem," he said,
staring straight ahead of him, his hands resting lightly on his knees.
"You don't seem altogether satisfied with events, do you, Gutteridge?" said Spears,
blowing a haze of smoke across the car. He leant forward and tapped the driver on the shoulder, waving him on. The car slowly pulled out of the dark alley into the bright sunlight of the busy airport car park.
"I could have just taken him outside, sir," said Gutteridge matter-of-factly. "Nothing elaborate. He'd be taken care of by now."
"Elaborate?"
echoed the man in a whisper. He exhaled a cloud of smoke and smiled lazily. His teeth glinted white in the sunlight. He had the grin of a lizard, thought Guttridge to himself.
They haven't told you what happened to your predecessor, then?
Smiled the man.
He thought much the same as you, until it was too late.
No, I told you. He's unpredictable. More dangerous than you're allowed to realize. We couldn't afford a scene.
And this won't cause a scene? Blurted out the heavy man incredulously. We needed to be sure, hissed the man angrily. There was no other way. He would have known. We had to do something he could never believe would happen. Besides, there are other reasons. A little bit of security.
He looked intently at Guttridge.
Anyway, it's none of your concern now. You've done your job well. A great service to your country. We've been after them for a lot of years. Now this is the end of it.
Yes, sir, sighed Guttridge. He looked out of the window as the car sped through town towards his next target.
Davison, come in. Can you hear me? Saul, are you there?
Davison drifted into consciousness to the sound of a concerned whisper in his earpiece.
Nix, is that you?
He croaked through parched lips. He brushed the dust from his visor. He was lying prone in the middle of the howling storm, half buried by the sand.
Oh, sweet Jesus, am I glad to hear you?
It was Starling's voice.
O'Keefe's safe too. We were getting worried about you there. I'm fine, I think,
said Davison, grimacing as he sat up. Every muscle in his body burned.
Where are you all?
He asked, looking around. He could see no visible landmarks through the dust clouds, only the pale sun occasionally breaking through.
Me and O'Keefe are together, said Nix over the comlink. We're hiding out from that thing in some caves near the camp. Starling's making his way to you. How are you doing, Gary? Okay, I think. The direction finding seems a little flaky in the storm. There's loads of interference, but I think I should be near you by now, he gasped.
It was hard going, trudging through the gale, encumbered by his heavy suit.
How long have I been out? Asked Davison. About 2 hours, answered Nix. We hid from the thing for a good while.
His voice shook as he spoke.
But we heard it flying off about an hour ago.
Okay, said Davison slowly, taking stock.
Well, first of all we need to meet up. Then we need to get back to base camp.
He shuddered as he spoke.
How many beacons have we missed? He asked.
There was an awkward silence.
Well, how many? He asked again.
None, replied Nix in a worried tone.
I don't understand it. There's been nothing at all.
Damn, that's odd.
Anyway, we need to get back to base camp before we can do anything else. If I know Grace, the next beacon will come through on a 5-minute countdown again, so we better be ready to go.
He tried to work out why they hadn't heard from control. Something must have gone badly wrong.
What if that thing comes back? Whispered Nix. And shouldn't they have sent a rescue team by now?
Oh, we'll find out at some point, I'm sure, answered Davison with mock levity. But anyway, I've stayed here long enough for one day, thank you.
Now, Gary, do you want me to stay put or shall I try and meet you? My tracker seems all screwed up in the storm. I can't pick any of you up at all.
He fiddled with the controls on the panel clipped to his forearm.
I know, everything electrical seems to be failing, gasped Starling. It must be something corrosive in the atmosphere. Just start walking, and I'll tell you if it's the wrong way.
After about 10 minutes, Davison saw the dark shape of Starling's suit loom out of the billowing dust clouds.
Good to see you, grinned Starling.
Ha, shit, now do I have to walk all the way back with you?
The exercise will do you good,
joked Davison, breathing hard.
It took a further 2 hours of hard trudging over the barren red rock, often going off course without realizing it, as Starling's tracking system started to fail. Eventually, they found the small fissure in a low cliff face where Nix and O'Keefe had holed up.
"Welcome to Shea Nightmare," smiled Nix,
as Davison and Starling squeezed into the cave and out of the scream of the storm.
"I would offer you a glass of wine, but it's the butler's day off,"
he sniggered as they slumped down into a heap. The cave was low and went back about 10 feet, sloping downwards. They all huddled together.
"Well, this is cozy," said Starling.
"Did you dump the sample claws?" asked Davison of Nix.
"Damn right," he replied, "else I'd never have kept up with my friend here."
He nodded towards O'Keefe, who sat crouched in the far corner.
"He sure can move when he's shitting his pants,"
he laughed bitterly. O'Keefe didn't respond. Davison thought he looked pretty strung out.
"Dan, are you all right? Dan!"
Davison shook O'Keefe's arm, and he jumped, staring around in panic.
"It's all right, Dan. We're going to get through this,"
Davison heard himself saying.
O'Keefe looked away. "We're all dead already," he whispered to himself.
"So, do we just sit tight and wait for the rescue team?" asked Starling, trying to sound confident.
"That all depends on how long you can hold your breath," joked Nix humorlessly.
Davison fumbled around for the gauge on his air tanks. He tapped the dial to make sure he was reading it correctly.
"Surely this can't be right," he whispered.
"Who said all that exercise was good for you?" smiled Nix.
The gauge read just under an hour before his air supply ran out.
You have been listening to The Heaven Field. For more information, downloads, and artwork, visit theheavenfield.com.